We'll go now to, we're going to skip to item 10 because I think there may be some from the Tax Commission who needed to leave, and I should have done this earlier. Property taxation of business personal property.
So beginning on page 69, lines 21, 22 through 21, 28, there is an existing statutory exemption for an item of tangible personal property with an acquisition cost of $1,000 or less that has reached a percent good and residual value of 15% or less. The requirement that the property has reached a percent good and residual value of 15% or less is repealed in this bill so that all items of tangible personal property with an acquisition cost of $1,000 or less are exempt. That's pretty much the whole of that expansion, but I just want to note for the committee that Article 13, Section 2 of the Utah Constitution requires all tangible property in the state that is not exempt under the laws of the United States or the under the Utah Constitution to be assessed at a uniform and equal rate in proportion to its fair market value and taxed at a uniform and equal rate. Property tax exemptions are listed in Article 13, Section 3 of the Utah Constitution, and specifically, subsection 2 of Article 13, Section 3 provides that the legislature may, by statute, exempt the following from property tax. Tangible personal property that, if subject to property tax, would generate an inconsequential amount of revenue. We are still conducting a legal analysis regarding whether the exemption authorized by this change would fall within the property tax exemption I described. As we go forward, we will work with the bill's sponsor in advising about the constitutionality of this provision.
Okay, so that's an explanation of the measure. Representative McKay, we're on your personal property exemption. And I understand that Chair Valentine is on his, is he going to, did he want to comment on this?
Address the item and move on. I can deliver his message on his behalf.
Well, we can go back to 9 and finish with that, and if he's here, then we'll come back to him. Are there any other, we've taken a lot of comment on this before lunch. Are there any in the audience who wish to speak on item 10? Just by show of hands. Okay, we'll come back to that when Senator, when Chair Valentine is here. Let's go now to 9A and B. We'll have those explained together, and then we'll have discussion on that one.
I'll start with 9A, which is the registration fee and the Road Usage Charge Advisory Committee. So beginning on page 18, lines 549 through 555, the registration fee for an electric vehicle is increased by $300 to a total of $344. In lieu of paying the increased $344 registration fee, an option is created for a registered owner of an electric vehicle to pay a $44 registration fee plus an amount determined through participation in a road usage charge program. The same concept is mirrored on page 19, lines 575 through 581, with reduced fees for a six-month registration. The revenue generated by the increased fee will be deposited in the transportation fund. These provisions governing the registration fee increase will take effect on July 1st, 2019. And then beginning on page 227, line 7023 of the bill, a Road Usage Charge Program Technical Advisory Committee is created within the Department of Transportation. This committee is charged with the responsibility of guiding the development and evaluation of a program to implement mileage-based revenue collection for Utah's roads and highways as an alternative to the gas tax system. On page 229, lines 7083 through 7084, UDOT is required to implement a road usage charge program on July 1, 2019, based on the recommendations of the Road Usage Charge Program Technical Advisory Committee. Beginning on page 230, line 7105, UDOT is required to prepare and submit a report on the road usage charge program to the Road Usage Charge Program Technical Advisory Committee, the Transportation Commission, and the Transportation and Revenue and Taxation Committees of the Legislature by no later than November 30th, 2018. The provisions regarding the Road Usage Charge Program Technical Advisory Committee take effect on May 8th, 2018. And noted on the fiscal impact, the increase of the registration we anticipate would be a positive fiscal impact to the transportation fund, but don't have details on those amounts.
This bill also proposes reinstating the expired tax credit for purchases or leases of energy efficient vehicles with the following modifications. This tax credit, which you can find on pages 90 through 91 and 107 through 17, would be limited to electric vehicles registered or operated in emissions non-attainment areas only. The previous credit that's now expired included hybrid vehicles and could be taken regardless of the location of the vehicle. The tax credit would be in effect for a period of 5 years, beginning in the 2018 taxable year and phasing out by 2023. For the first 2 years, the credit is worth between $750 to $1,500, depending on the type of electric vehicle purchased. By 2022, the last year of the credit, the credit's worth between $100 and $300, depending on the type of electric vehicle purchased. The credit amount for leased vehicles would be a percentage of the credit amount for that same type of vehicle had it been purchased. The third modification to the now expired tax credit is that the tax credit would be able to be assigned to a financing entity and could be received at the time of purchase or lease from the financing entity. The financing entity could charge a $150 administrative fee for providing this service. The fourth modification is that the changes to this tax credit also increase oversight of the tax credit. This bill proposes adding oversight of the tax credit by requiring the taxpayer or the financing entity to receive a tax credit certificate before claiming the credit. To obtain that tax credit certificate, the taxpayer must submit an application to the Division of Air Quality with proof of the purchase price of the vehicle, and in the case of the financing entity claiming the tax credit, proof of the assignment. The tax credit must also be studied by the committee annually for revisions or even elimination. The final modification is that only the first $125,000 in tax credits claimed during a fiscal year will be paid out of the education fund. The education fund would be reimbursed by the general fund for any tax credits claimed over that $125,000. If you refer to item 9B on the fiscal impacts document, you will see that the fiscal impact is not yet known, but it will be a cost to the state. How significant that cost is depends on the number of credits claimed. That concludes our presentation of the summary of this portion of the bill.
Thank you. After talking with those involved in the in this industry and those advocating for cleaner air, and also working with the Tax Commission, it appears that this vehicle miles traveled issue is not ready for prime time because the technology is not there. And so our enactment of a vehicle miles traveled alternative to a 20,000-mile assumption of usage by an electric vehicle just doesn't work. So it looks like we will either have to draw that back to, say, 10,000 miles if we want electric vehicles to pay something toward their use of the roads or some other indicator. And so that's where we're going, just so you know that what's currently in the bill doesn't look like it's workable. And so we'll be working with the industry folks and also with the Tax Commission on bringing some alternative to you. Any questions on that? Representative Briscoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do we need to put in place for us to do a VMT experiment? Pilot like Oregon, what are we lacking?
I'm probably not the right one to answer that. If there's somebody else in the audience who is better equipped to answer that. Otherwise, I'll give it an attempt based on what the discussions I've had.
Here comes someone.
Good. Saved by the bell.
I'm Elizabeth Waite with UDOT. So the technology is available, but it's still being tested. So we're part of the Western Road User Consortium, and it's 14 states that are all looking at different studies, looking at different elements of how to implement the technology. So while the technology itself exists, the implementation of it, like even things as seemingly simple as how to install it in a vehicle and who's responsible for that and when to install it, like issues like that are still being worked through. So right now, there's pretty intensive effort from different states to look at how the technology can work and then how it gets administered. But to answer your question, the technology is relatively new, but it's there. But how it gets implemented within a system that can be administered is a different story.
How is Oregon doing it? They've been doing it for 2 years.
Yeah,
as a pilot.
And
like
I think
2,000 to 3,000 people.
About six.
6,000 people.
Six studies, and so that was specifically in their most recent report. That was one of the things that they talked about was those issues of the logistics of installation of the technology was one of the major barriers that volunteer participants said was a problem for them. It was
GPS.
A non-starter for some. So that's an option, but that is what they're looking at. Do you just go with the GPS unit, or do you go with a state-specified unit, or do you do something else altogether, or do you offer different options, and what does that range of options look like? So those are the types of issues that Oregon's looking at right now.
Well, I'm volunteering for the pilot when you get it going. I mean, why should we limit this when we get it going to electric vehicles? I'd be willing to take a year or two and take the risk of saying I'll pay my vehicle miles traveled as opposed to my gas tax just to see what it looks like.
So I will make a note of that.
I'm volunteering. Thank you. So,
I'll volunteer too.
Mr. Chair, we'll do it together.
Yeah.
I waited for you to be here because I so needed that today, Representative. So my next question, Mr. Chair, is how we determined $344 as on line 533 as the amount to charge an electric vehicle for taxes in lieu of gas taxes.
And that of course, will be removed. But it was based on 20,000 miles at an average vehicle per mile use, plus, I think, the $44 that comes from...
That's the existing registration fee.
That's the existing registration fee.
Because I think Washington and California are charging $150.
Right. That's
that's on the high end. I think
that's based on fewer miles. What we were doing is basing it on a higher mile amounts to entice people to voluntarily do the vehicle miles travel.
The old carrot and the stick approach.
Right.
They
prefer the carrot than the stick. But that's off the table now. We're going to have to, because the technology just isn't there.
So stay tuned.
Right.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure glad you were here.
Thank you.
Any others who want to comment on this component? So it'll be redrawn, and we'll have it for later consideration. So let's move then, if we can, to the final consideration of the item 10, which we had begun our discussion on. We'll bring Commissioner Rockwell and our sponsor of this, Representative McKay, is also here to comment.
I understand that Commission Chair Valentine is in the building. I'll go ahead and get started with the issue, and then if he comes in, he can take it from there. I know that this was a concern that he wanted to make sure that the committee was aware of. This is a concern with existing law. It is not a concern with the – I mean, it's perpetuated in the bill, but it is not a concern that is a new concern because of the bill. It's the language in existing law that provides for an exemption for property that has an acquisition cost of $1,000 or less. And then it also has the depreciation language that is repealed in the bill. And under the current law, with that language that provides that property has an acquisition cost of $1,000 or less, the commission has two challenges in administering that. The first is with unitary property that is valued as a unit, trying to ascertain the value of individual pieces of property is difficult. We also have concerns where property is purchased in bulk, say 100 pots and pans are purchased for one non-itemized price of $1,500. Whether and how to break that out by piece for purposes of determining the $1,000 or aggregating them all together. One thing that we could suggest to address that issue, if the committee is interested, is also, in addition to removing the depreciation language, to also delete that acquisition cost of $1,000 or more, and perhaps raising the $10,000 limit to some other limit, like, for example, $30,000. We understand that staff is exploring constitutional issues, as Ms. Halverson stated, relating to the legislation. And one thing that the committee could consider there is making a legislative finding that the legislature finds that the threshold that the legislature sets meets the inconsequential amount of revenue standard established in the Constitution, and then leave it to the courts to decide whether to defer to the legislature's policymaking authority on that. Those are the items that Commission Chair Valentine wanted to convey to the committee. I don't know if he's walked. He's just walked in, and we're happy to answer questions on that.
Good. Let me, while Commissioner Valentine is getting briefed, let me just brief Representative McKay to the fact that we had, I think it was three persons testifying this morning before lunch because they had to leave, supporting this legislation. Oh, I think it was more than three. And, you were listening, so you heard all of that. Okay, good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Valentine, Chairman of the Commission. I appreciate very much the indulgence of the committee to hold this at the end so I could come back. I understand that Commissioner Rockwell has indicated that that we would support a $30,000 amount as increasing the overall exemption to try to be responsive to the taxpayers having to keep track of things, and then having the changes that are already indicated in the bill would, I think, address that as well. But we wanted to make certain that the Commission gave a word of warning on this particular issue because we wanted to make certain that we recognize that the constitutional provision has a specific provision that we think would be helped if we make these kind of changes in personal property, that the legislature does some fact-finding, and that specifically the fact-finding be done on the issue of whether or not this particular thing is going to have what kind of effect it'll have on the overall property system. In other words, if we look at the constitutional provision, we find that there is what we sometimes refer to as a de minimis provision, that it has a very small impact on the overall property tax. Everyone recognizes it's a shift. It's a shift from personal property to real property. But I think what's something that people have not recognized, two issues that come up in the personal property issue as we increase this exemption. The first one is the hardest one, and that is what to do with centrally assessed taxpayers. The other provisions of the Constitution require equal and uniform treatment of all taxpayers. So if we give locally assessed property $1,000, $10,000, or $30,000 exemption, we're going to end up at some point in time where that exemption is going to be large enough that the central assessed taxpayers will rightfully say, you know what, we should be entitled to it as well. So we're thinking that perhaps we ought to also provide in the central assessed section that they get a $30,000 exemption as well, just to make certain that we have that equal and uniform provision. The second thing that the legislature needs to do, though, is to make that finding in regards to what the effect is because of the provisions of the Constitution that says that it is that the legislature has limited authority, and that limited authority is just for those personal property exemptions which are de minimis in amounts. Those are the two things we want to give as a warnings that the commission felt like we needed to have on the record so that the committee would be aware of it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative McKay has some questions or question.
Commissioner, thank you for your advice. I think that's probably will help inform some decisions as the bill moves forward. Do you mind if I ask you, you kind of mentioned two issues. Let me deal with the last one, where we talk about centrally assessed being treated equally as locally assessed. And I assume you're still talking about personal property, right?
Yes, that okay. is correct. And,
okay.
And every centrally assessed taxpayer is going to have personal property. I mean,
right.
It's obvious. It's a priori.
Okay. So as the bill is drafted now, it gives the benefit to the locally assessed, but locally assessed personal property, and doesn't give the same benefit to the centrally assessed, because that's not the way I read it. So I'm trying to find that issue.
It seems to give to both, but we want to make certain that the committee understands that we're going to be treating them both the same, and that in centrally assessed taxpayers' calculation, we're going to have to make the calculation as well. We haven't been doing that to this point, and we're trying to make certain that you recognize that that's what we're going to be doing in the future.
Okay, so how do we do it differently for centrally assessed that we don't?
I think we just take a $30,000 deduct from their value, because that's the same amount that they...
Because they aren't itemizing is what you're saying.
That's correct.
Okay.
Remember how we value centrally assessed taxpayers.
Yeah.
We don't go in and value all the component parts. We say, what is the total unitary value of this worldwide? Now, how much of that is allocable to Utah?
Yeah.
But as we determine that value worldwide, we take that value worldwide, we then reduce it by the intangibles, because we can't tax for property tax purposes the intangible value of that unitary business. We take out the intangibles, we end up with a net value that it's then allocated to Utah. We're proposing that to keep it the same, we also give them a $30,000 deduction, just like we're giving local assessed ones, because they're going to have at least $30,000 worth of personal property.
Okay. In your earlier statement, I think you kind of went back and forth between locally assessed personal property and locally assessed real property, and I was it's probably because you were hurrying in. So I think now I understand that element, and I'm not sure necessarily that just granting them a blanket $30,000 discount will necessarily solve the problem, but I can see that issue. If you don't mind, are there other ways to do it that you thought about but weren't the $30,000 just wholesale cut off of their valuation?
Well, you gave us a challenge last time to come up with a way to make it work, and that was the way we had proposed to make it work.
Were there other ways that didn't work?
The problem you have is when you start breaking up components is trying to determine how much of a component you're going to have on each individual item. That was getting to be harder and harder for us to deal with. You and I talked offline about a computer system.
Yeah.
Is each computer system at $1,000? Because this monitor is less than $1,000. This keyboard is less than $1,000. This server is only $9.99. This workstation is only $9.99. So are each one of those individually componentized? And that becomes very difficult to keep track of, especially on a centrally assessed taxpayer, which we're not even looking at the values of those personal properties. We're only looking at the overall value of the company.
Yeah, so it seems like with locally assessed personal property, there's some type of locus element, right? Where it's located. The equipment is readily there. We can find it. It's part of part of the taxable value. For a centrally assessed, since it's not itemized, not broken out, the total valuation of the business divided by its apportioned value in Utah, then becoming its assessed value. And it wouldn't be better than to have them itemize their personal property that's located in the state of Utah.
That would be really tough. But if you want to put that kind of a burden on centrally assessed taxpayers, I guess you could. But you'd have to change your legislation to do that.
Yeah. I'm not willing to pass any burden onto them that I'm not willing to pass on to locally. Ideally, I just wouldn't tax personal property at all.
And but of course, we changed the Constitution. You got it.
Just based on the number of spears that got pointed my direction, I don't know if that will necessarily work as well as I would like it to. But you know, absent the constitutional issue, that would be what I would do in a perfect world, and that would solve the locally assessed, you know, or the centrally assessed issue just as well. So maybe what we're arguing is it's a constitutional change as much as anything else. Can I go back to the other question then on the de minimis amount and why you arrived at 30,000 versus any other number to what we decided from a constitutional perspective meets the de minimis?
Okay, let's focus in on that for a minute because I think it's a fair question. We're actually dealing with the constitutional provision, Article 13, Section 3, yeah. Subpart 2, Subpart A, Subpart VI.
Do you want me to recite it to you?
Yes, recite it back, please.
Please, okay. Go ahead.
I'm making a record here, you know.
I know.
The legislature may by statute exempt the following from property tax, going down, tangible personal property that, if subject to property tax, would generate an inconsequential amount of revenue. That is the authority that the legislature has to exempt from the general provisions of Article 13 that all personal property and real property be taxed at an equal and uniform rate at its fair market value. That's the exemption that the legislature can use. And that's the exemption that we've used to come up with the present situation. If we're going to increase it in response to the pleas of some of our small businesses, we're saying that you ought to do some type of a analysis, a legislative finding, a legislative fact finding to determine that the amount that you're increasing it to still has an inconsequential amount of revenue that's being generated. Now, I don't know whether that means for individual taxpayers or in the aggregate for the whole state or the aggregate for a specific county or a specific city. Right. There's no case law to be able to help us there.
Okay. And that supports what Commissioner Rockwell was talking about, which is then we leave it to the courts on whether or not they defer to our legislative policy judgment.
That's correct. And that's why we're suggesting that you do it more than just a blanket finding, that you actually do some work. Have your staff do some work, and let's find out what the consequences would be of making that kind of a change. And then you'll know, and then you can decide, well, maybe that isn't a good policy. Maybe $20,000 would be better, because right now it's only indexed to $10,300.
Mm-hmm.
And I use 30,000
yeah.
purely as an example.
Yep, I didn't expect it to be a binding number. I get that. So, really, what the other way that we could, you know, carve the turkey, so to speak, since a recent holiday being considered, you know, if the de minimis amount is its fully depreciated life. So, for example, when the asset is acquired, and if it depreciates over 3 or 5 years or whatever its full depreciation schedule is, if at the end of its measurable life it would generate, in theory, zero.
That's candidly why the legislature, prior to this time, made the decision to retain the 15%. Because at those things that get down to 15% of value no longer have to be counted.
Yeah, and that's why I'm just thinking, you know, if that measurement of de minimis was, because right now, and you know, Commissioner Rockwell said it right. I mean, when you stop taxing business personal, or when you stop taxing personal property, and it's where it's at, it is a tax shift. But let's not be mistaken; that shift is happening already. It's happening every day. And every year, you know, as a company acquires more and depreciates more, that depreciation factor is being shifted to the taxpayer almost immediately after purchase. And so that's, you know, part of the complaint when we were looking at, you know, House Bill 25 a couple of years ago was trying to end that shift, so to speak. But that shift, you know, still is occurring in lesser magnitude for sure. So if we just looked at from a constitutional measure and said, well, if we added by the end of its depreciation cycle, if it's adding de minimis value, it shouldn't be taxed. And ideally, that's how the Constitution would be written, right? To me, in my world, in my view of the Constitution. So I just need to probably make some policy decisions because I'm just not sure that we should continue down this path we're doing now. You know, all things being considered, but I think both of your findings are valid and we probably need to, or both of your recommendations are valid and we probably need to do a little bit of groundwork to get that done. So thank you very much.
And again, Representative, thank you because our discussions that we had offline led to some of these things that we're proposing today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further public comment on item number 10? Okay. Before we adjourn, I'd like to give Bryant Howe a large shout out. This is his final committee meeting as an employee, longtime employee of the legislature. And the co-chairs are very grateful for your many years of service to the legislature and to the citizens of Utah. My only regret is I didn't get to work with you longer. So thank you very much. I believe there is a little reception coming up. Would you mind clarifying? I know it's a hard thing for you to probably tell us, but just clarify when that's going to be.
Count down the minutes.
You don't have to take it down to the seconds. Just days is fine.
See, what's today? The 27th, so 1 month, 2 days, but who's counting? So, yeah, it's December 12th from 3 to 5 in the gold room. So
it's not lost on us that you're retiring right before the session, by the way.
It's not by accident. So.
The timing is everything. So thank you, Senator Stevenson.
You know, I have to remember when he came on staff here. I seriously do. I had been working for the Taxpayers Association for 3 years as a lobbyist up here, and he came on as a freshman analyst. And I think you've been with tax from the very outset.
Off and on.
Off and on, off yeah. On but you've kind of been the – and I don't know why you couldn't stick around a little longer. I mean, you're still a spring chicken. By the way, it's interesting the way people from families come here to work here. Many people may not know that his father, Bryant's father, is Chief Justice Richard Howe of the Utah Supreme Court. And so this public service attitude is something that is strongly held in his family. Also, we've had a similar thing. I think Bill Asplund was one of your trainers, and his son now works for legislative research, too. So we get a good crop of genes going on here.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our agenda. We have no further business. I'd like to thank our staff for their very hard work in the preparation for this as well as the other interim meetings. It's been a very high hurdle that we've asked them to rise to. And we look forward to feedback from the committee regarding the various policy matters we've discussed today as we work on crafting this and other bills for the general session. So having said that, I will look for one final motion.
To make it a committee bill? Is that the final motion?
I will rule that motion out of line. I think I heard Representative McKay motion to adjourn. That's non-debatable. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We stand adjourned.